After having seen the problems related to the acquisition level from the point of view of the microprocessor, now we deal with the level so-called devoted to the measurement. In other words, in this level, in this part of the overall elaboration, the measurement is produced, but this means that what arrives from the transducer must be converted into a variable that reflects the physical magnitude measurement units, and this requires to take into the account the components of the acquisition chain, their transfer function, the gain, and every characteristic that allows this transformation. Sometimes the values that are calculated are expressed with single floating point precisions, sometimes using the double one. The steps into which the measurement level is exploited feature linearization, ADC conversion, calibration, derived measurement calculation, and digital filtering. Concerning the linearization and the conversion steps, we have to see that the relationship between the final value that is acquired by the microprocessor and the measured one can be represented by a line crossing or not the zero axis, or generally speaking by a curve. In the slide number 51, a generic curve is shown that could be considered the result of the assembly process of all the transfer function of the components that characterize the acquisition chain. You see that just to fix the ideas, in the horizontal axis we have a range of possible values expressed as binary numbers. So the minimum value is 0, the maximum one is 2 power n minus 1, and is the number of the bits of the ADC. And in this hypothesis, we are considering a converter unipolar that is providing results in the range of the positive numbers. Conversely, on the vertical axis, we have the measured value that corresponds to a particular binary number. And you see that if the binary numbers go from 0 to a maximum, that is the maximum number that can be represented by the ADC. For the measured value, we talk of a starting value and a full scale value, that is the minimum and the maximum that are not necessarily zero, or the maximum value that can be represented, that can be measured, better to say. What is the possible representation of such a kind of curve inside the microprocessor? We have three possibilities, of course. The first one is that the overall transfer function of the acquisition chain is a zero crossing line. In this case, the relationship between L, that is the output of the ADC, and M, that is the final internal representation of the microprocessor, is of course reduced to a coefficient, as written in the slide 52. M is equal to Km times L. Km is the inverse of the overall chain gain, so Instead of considering L as only the output of the ADC, we could say that L is the output of the transducer, or even the physical magnitude as it is read by the transducer. If the C is the point of view into which we consider to be, Km includes all the transfer functions of the transducer, of the multiplexer, of the sample and hold, of the amplifier, of the analog to digital converter. Of course, there is the possibility that such a kind of line doesn't cross the zero axis, therefore the representation is similar, but in terms of what it is necessary in the microprocessor to identify it, you see the second equation that basically says that we need a couple of points together with their coordinates. These points are MZ and LZ, MS and LS, that are LZ, the point into which the line corresponds to the low scale value, let's say in the range of the possible values that it can assume, and on the horizontal axis this value will correspond to the minimum value that has been read by the transducer. Conversely, the couple MS and LS will correspond to the point in the diagram that is located at 3 on 4 of the full scale of the variable that we are considering. This point is called span point, while the couple MZ, LZ is called zero point. Also, it doesn't correspond really to a zero, but to the minimum value that in the scale of the measured values can be considered. The most general representation of the relationship between the value that the transducer acquires and the measure representation internal to the microprocessor is a generic curve. And it can be described by an array of points that must be interpolated, or in the most lucky cases it corresponds to an analytical curve that can be represented through a suitable but low number of coefficients. For example, in the slide 52 we have that the measured value is A times the square of the acquired value plus B times the linear value of the acquired magnitude plus C. Therefore, the internal representation of the microprocessor is ABC, is let's say the storing of only three coefficients. Another issue is related to the calibration of the characteristic curve. The parameters that represent the relationship between the measured physical magnitude and the acquired value by the transducer may be not completely known or can change during the time due to thermal effect, environmental conditions, usage, degradation. The calibration is the part of the activity related to the acquisition that concerns the physical setting of the chain components, so as each one will work in nominal conditions. This will tackle, for example, the elimination of suitable offset voltages in the output of some of the components in the acquisition chain, or if it is not possible to eliminate them, simply the identification of the amount of such an offset, so as it can be taken into account or eventually cancelled in the software that is running on the microprocessor. Another issue is related to the setup of the necessary gain for making the output of the transducer to fall in the correct range of the ADC, so as to exploit completely its capability of conversion, and more and more and more. The final curve will be the product of the theoretical nominal component characteristics, if this is possible. This could be called hardware calibration, but during the life of the acquisition chain, there is another calibration, a software calibration, that aims to identify the real parameters of the acquisition that survive the transient phases, and this is possible, or this can be obtained, by providing the system with the input known values of the measured physical magnitude. We call them MI, so as to determine how they are acquired from the real hardware that we are using, and so to determine the deviation from the ideal theoretical curve. This software calibration could be done at the beginning of the measurement campaign, and surely on a periodic basis. For example, in the picture shown in the slide 53, you see that we have a relationship between a set of values L0, L1, L2, L3, L4, L5. These are known variables. For example, we use a thermocouple set at 6 known well-established temperatures, and we go to see how these values are read by the microprocessor. That is, we identify a knowledge, we could say a posteriori, that allows to us to draw the curve that is shown in the picture simply by interpolation of the experimental points. And clearly, this curve will probably be not the ideal one, but is the real one that we have at our disposal, and therefore is the one that allows us to reconstruct the real physical value of the magnitude that we are measuring when we will read the next M0, M1, M2, M3, M4, M5 values. This calibration can be performed automatically or in a semi-automatic way, that is, the values can be provided in an automatic way by the PC or by the operator manually, and the final step will allow to obtain estimation of the parameters through the best fitting of the curve obtained, if this curve is a generic one, or through an array of points MILI if the curve is similar to a line. A not trivial problem that affects the measurement level is the phase into which derived measurements are calculated. In other words, secondary magnitudes can be calculated from those acquired and read by the microprocessor. For example, imagine a volumetric or a mass flow rate. We know that these two values, these two parameters, are calculated by the product, for example, of the section of the tube into which a fluid is passing, time, the velocity of a suitable transducer that can be inserted in such a kind of tube. The transducer could be, for example, an incremental encoder, and the flow rate will be the product between A, the section, and the velocity obtained. Another example, if we use a thermocouple, we know that the output voltage of the transducer is proportional to the difference of temperature at the two extremities of the thermocouple. But if we want to obtain an absolute temperature, we have to add to such a kind of device another small transducer that gives one of the two temperatures to which the thermocouple is related, so have to add it to the output voltage of the thermocouple and obtaining the other temperature, the absolute value of the other temperature. Derived measurement, indeed. We need to take care of some issues in this case. For example, if the derived measurements are obtained through a subtraction, we must pay attention to the quantization errors, because if the first measurement is affected by, let's say, positive quantization error with respect to the real value that is acquired, and the second measurement is affected by a negative quantization error, the subtraction between them will, let's say, augment the inaccuracy, because we'll add the two quantization errors. Moreover, if we are calculating an integration function and the magnitude that we are considering, the value that we have acquired, is affected by a systematic error, that is an offset, for example, clearly at the end of the integration we will have a consistent effect on the overall results that we will have calculated. Conversely, if instead of an integration function we are calculating a derivation function, in this case, considering that the numeric implementation of a derivation is an incremental ratio between the present sample and the previous one of a variable divided by the sampling period, if one of the two samples is affected by a random error or a jitter, clearly the value of the derivation can diverge, and therefore can be should be considered not reliable. This can be solved by, let's say, considering larger instant of time, larger intervals of time on which to calculate the derivation function. But it is a possibility that should be considered. And finally, if we are performing the acquisition of very fast variable magnitudes, we need to augment the sampling frequency, but clearly this has a limit, considering the cutoff frequencies of all the components in the chain, and even not the capability of the microprocessor, because typically modern microprocessors are able to track to be up to the job of any physical phenomenon we can imagine. But the problem is in this case that we don't want to dedicate completely the most prestigious, the most important resource that we have in the chain to a task like this. Numeric filtering is that activity through which the values that have been acquired are replaced with more suitable values obtained by deleting or manipulating those errors due to noise, to disturbances, supposed they are random. This can be done on the basis of a suitable knowledge that includes the physical model of the phenomenon. That is, we know that the process we are monitoring features a certain behavior, therefore the acquired value is not suitable, is not reliable. The characteristic curve of the overall acquisition chain, and this means that we know that some components could have cutoff frequencies, therefore it is not suitable to consider their response at frequencies higher that higher than that value, and in general at values into which the process cannot work. The model of the noise, typically if the noise is white, a low pass filter clearly will cancel it, because it will add negative and positive components as well, therefore providing a result that is mainly null. The model of the user, because the user can, for example, work at certain velocities, therefore those errors that happen at specific frequencies or in specific conditions don't affect the activity of the user. And the difference between the sampling frequency and the necessary frequency. For a certain process, we can decide to sample at a frequency that is 4, 5, even 10 times the frequency of the signal that we have identified as a process variable. But this will bring to sample not only the effective and useful signal, but for example some errors or some noise. And simply by relaxing the sampling, by considering lower frequencies, we can simply filter out those errors that otherwise will affect the process variable that we are monitoring. A numeric filter allows good and stable filtering, even with low cutoff frequencies where the time dynamics could be quite long. An easy calibration of the characteristic parameters, because we trust on the fact that eventually errors or not accurate issues in the response of a specific device can be let's say tolerated, because the numeric filter will cancel or will reduce their effects. Even a better resolution of the used ADC, because for example we can eliminate some effects that affect the signal, therefore to establish more accuracy than the ADC can provide, because the number of the bits are too many and the noise that affects the signal could be high, therefore we are not able to be more accurate than what the noise allows to us. But if we eliminate that noise, we will let's say recover the precision that the ADC originally assured to us. In the slide 56, the most generic expression of a filter is shown. We indicate with the I of K the kth input sample to the filter, the present sample of the variable that we are acquiring, while U of K is the value of the filter output at the kth sample, at the kth instant. The generic expression foresees that u of k is equal to minus a suitable coefficient a1 times the value of u at the previous instant, at the previous sample, minus a2 times the value of u two samples before, and more and more and more up to minus an time the value of u at the nth sample before the present one. To this quantity, we add the linear combination of suitable coefficients b0, b1, b2, bm time the value of the input to the filter at the present instant k and up to the instant the sample k minus m. In other words, we consider the value of the present output of the filter as the sum of the effects due to the history of the variable u itself, since we consider a certain window of previous values, added to another window that includes the input values multiplied by suitable coefficients. If a is equal to zero, this filter is called moving average filter, since the output is given by a certain combination of the inputs values, and the answer of such a kind of filter is finite when the input is a pulse. Instead, if AI is not zero, this filter is called autoregressive, and its answer to a pulse is infinite, because it depends on the history previously considered of the output itself. The general expression that identifies such a kind of filter is ARMA, autoregressive moving average. Autoregressive because part of the output is due to the previous history of the output itself. Moving average because another part of the output is due to the average suitably weighted of the previous values of the input to the filter itself. We define a filter causal if the output at a certain kth instant is a function of the previous k minus I values. This kind of a filter is a direct kind of a filtering, that is, the result is produced online contemporaneously to the variable that we are acquiring, with a delay effect due to the fact that the output is a suitable linear combination of a certain group of inputs. Therefore, we have to wait all the inputs before producing the new output. A filter, on the other hand, is defined as not causal if the specific output is a function both of previous and of successive values. Clearly, in this case, we abandon the dimension of the time, that is, this kind of filter are not applied to time signals, but on the contrary, they are applied to spatial image filtering, for example, that is, it's a typical example of offline filtering. In the slide 57, an example of what moving average means is shown. You see two pictures. The first is the effect due to the classic fixed average filtering. The second is instead the moving average approach. Normally, we consider a group of values of a suitable variable and we replace them with the average applied, calculated on those n samples. And this is shown by the first picture. They can consider it, let's say, equivalent to an ARM filter with AI equal to 0 and BI equal to 1 divided by M. M is the window of samples that we are considering and on which we are calculating the average. A moving average filtering, on the other hand, is an expression like that shown in the second picture. For example, UK is equal to the sum of IK plus IK minus 1 plus IK minus 2 divided by 3. But the difference in this case is that every sample is replaced with the average of the previous ones, considering the window that we have defined. Instead, in the fixed average filtering, for example, three samples, as they are shown in the picture, are replaced by the average calculated. That is, before the filtering, we have three samples. After the filtering, we have only one value. On the contrary, you see in the second picture that every value is the result of the average filtering applied to the m previous values. Therefore, we see that a certain delay effect is present in such a kind of calculation. We have, for example, a pulse that is filtered with such a method, and clearly we see that the filtered curve, that is the red one in the picture, will converge to the upper value of the pulse only after three steps, only after three samples. And this is the effect that this kind of we could say low-pass filtering applies to the time evolution of the signal. It is possible to evaluate such a kind of delay. We don't demonstrate it, but we can say that it is equal to the product of the sampling period time 1 plus m, the window amplitude, divided by 2. The answer to a square wave input will be zero after a time that is equal to the product of the number of the samples that we use for the average time the sampling period. Clearly, such a kind of method requires the presence of a suitable memory block to store the last m samples. Typically, such a kind of memory block is a circular buffer if M is high. And a possible implementation in C language is shown in the slide number 58. In the slide 58, we see that a suitable buffer called camp NC, that is an array, contains the values of the samples of a suitable variable. Val, instead, is the average value that is evaluated in two ways, if you look at the code. That is, in the classic traditional way, as the sum of all the cells of the array divided by the number of the components. And in another mode, that is faster, because it involves only the particular sample that has been entered into the circular buffer. Let's look closely to the code. First of all, we see that this is a subroutine that receives the specific sample value as a parameter, a float value, and considering the index I of the circular buffer, the first operation that is done is a comparison that identifies if this index exceeds the number of the locations of the array. In that case, the index is set again to the beginning of the array itself. This is what carries out the concept of a circular buffer that when is at the end of its amplitude starts again from the beginning in a very in a real circular concept. Therefore, after having filled the last location, the next one will be the location zero. Then the code performs a test on the value of the variable I. That is, if I is different from zero, perform the evaluation of the moving average, let's say in an incremental way. Otherwise, look at the code that is under the directive else, perform the calculation of the average in the classic way. What does it mean to evaluate the moving average as an incremental approach? You see that the value of val, the average that is performed by this code, is equal to its own previous value plus the value of the present sample minus the value of the correspondent value, the correspondent location of the circular buffer camp in the present I index point, divided by the number of the samples in the circular array. And then, after this, the present sample replaces the previous one in the present location of the circular buffer. That is, the circular buffer is conceived as a set of memory cells, and when I have a new sample, the contribution of the previous one to the value of the average value is subtracted, the contribution of the present sample is added. Note that the present contribution and the old contribution must be divided by the number of the components of the array, that in this case is 8. And this is the very simple approach that allows to keep at every step the moving average upgraded with respect to the last 8 samples. Upgraded considering the last 8 samples, and by doing a Campione Menocamp of I divided by NC, these two operations are performed at the same time. The older one exits, the new one enters. The reason for calculating the moving average in such a way is related to the fact that if we perform the evaluation in the traditional way, every time we make a lot of calculations that are useless, because the only term that causes a modification in the moving average is the present sample. All the other ones, if added, are same as before, Therefore, their contribution is the same as in the previous step. So there is no reason for calculating them as contributors to the moving average. And this piece of code exactly reproduces this idea, this concept. On the other hand, you see that once upon a time, we have the moving average calculated in the usual way, that is, the present sample is assigned to the location I of the circular buffer, a variable called sum, the overall sum, is reset to zero, and then we have a small for cycle that increases the value of sum with every considered location of the circular array camp. And finally, sum is assigned to the value, to the variable val, divided by nc. Clearly, the division by nc is done outside the for cycle, because otherwise we repeat nc times a division, and instead we only do this one time at the end. But we see that the traditional approach is nevertheless used in this code. But when? When I is equal to 0. What it is important is not that I is equal to 0, but the fact that the traditional approach is done one time every 8, that is, every calculations of all the contributions relative to the locations of the circular array. The utility of this approach, of this calculation, is related to the fact that maybe randomly, but the variable campione, that is the sample, could assume a very strange and outlier value. For example, due to a particular, maybe atmospherical phenomenon, or a rebound on the power line. Whatever reason can justify the value anomalous of the variable sample, of the variable campione. For example, imagine that this variable is equal to 30 million. When we perform the subtraction of 30 million with another value, for example 10, you understand that in this case the accuracy, the precision of the internal representation of the microprocessor, in particular related to the floating point numbers that we are using in this code, is important. And if we perform 30 millions minus 10, the precision of the microprocessor could be not enough accurate to assure that this subtraction is done. Maybe the subtraction will provide a result as 0 is subtracted from 30 millions. In other terms, the precision of the microprocessor is not enough to represent the distance in terms of exponent of magnitude between a high number and a low number. The net result of this is the big number is the low one. Or, if you want, this one disappears from the calculation. Clearly, this introduces an error in the estimation of the average, and this error will affect the evaluation forever, because in a certain moment of this incremental approach, instead of performing the subtraction 30 millions minus 10, we practically did 30 millions minus 0, and this is wrong. If we don't correct this error the overall evaluation of the average, of the moving average, will be wrong, will be affected by this problem. But you know that time after time, even the 30 million value will be replaced in the array in the circular buffer, therefore will exit from the buffer, but the error will be still present. This is the reason why sometimes the calculation is done in the traditional way. By doing the evaluation of the moving average as the sum of all the components of the circular buffer divided by the number of the components, we, in practice, reset the calculation. We restart the average evaluation, because when that outlier value will exit from the buffer, the calculation of the average done in the traditional way will simply cancel its effect. Otherwise, if we would continue with the previous incremental method, the original error did at a certain epoch will continue to influence the evaluation of the moving average. This is the reason why we have, let's say, this differential path in the code that most of the times evaluates the average as an incremental ratio between the difference of the present sample and the older one divided by the number of the components of the circular buffer, but at the beginning of the filling of the circular buffer performs the evaluation of the moving average as usual, as the sum of all the locations divided by the number of the elements of the array itself. Another kind of filtering that is popular and often applied in signal processing is the so-called exponential. In this case, the coefficients feature different values that allow to highlight or to increase the contribution of certain parts of the signal that has been sampled, while other parts are, let's say, diminished in their effects on the overall average. The example that we are considering in this case is very simple, just to understand how the filter works, but typically this is not the case, and the implementation of an exponential filtering requires a very fast microcomputing unit to avoid to affect the real-time elaboration of the acquired signal. In the slide number 59, a tentative, let's say, demonstration of the effect of an exponential filtering is presented, showing a signal that is averaged with the mobile average in red and with the exponential average in blue, and we see that the second one is able to track more closely the behavior of the signal. In our case, we consider the first coefficient A1 equal to a certain constant value, CF, and the second coefficient, B0, equal to 1 minus CF. Remember that the first weights the history of the signal that is filtered, while the second one weights the contribution of the different input samples to the filtering block considered. Therefore, if CF is low, the output will be mainly due to the input effect. If CF will be high, the output will be mainly due to its own history. It is possible to demonstrate that even in this case, the introduction of such a kind of filtering brings a delay in the elaboration, and this delay is equal to the sample time divided by 1 minus CF. Moreover, we can simplify the evaluation of the present filtered sample in output by reformulating the expression that we have seen as I kth sample plus the coefficient that multiplies the difference between uk minus 1 and ik. This reduces the number of the multiplications that must be done and therefore makes the calculation less complex. A particular interesting issue is how to implement an algorithm like this when we have a microprocessor that features only an integer point unit in its architecture. In other words, is not able to perform floating point calculations like an algorithm like this should require, since the coefficient is included with between 0 and 1. In the slide 60, we have written a very short code that approximates the calculation of such a kind of exponential filter using a completely integer mathematic, integer, let's say, set of operations. However, the values that we are considering are scaled by a proper coefficient. In other words, we consider registers with 16 bits and the coefficient is transformed in 2 power 16 if equal to 1, is expressed as 8000 in hexadecimal or 32768 if equal to 0.5, and more and more and more. In other words, we have transformed a coefficient that is expressed as a floating point number into an integer value in a dynamic equal to 16 bits, and therefore we need to work not with only one 16-bit register but with more registers. Let's understand how to do it. Let's consider that the new filtered value, that is the output of the calculation, will be upgraded at every call of this routine and will be contained into a specific register. Let's consider this value with the name UF, that is, we have a memory location into which the output of this filter, of this calculation, is stored so as to be used the next time as the previous filtered output. The same way, we have another memory location that is called IR, that is the filter input, the sample of the variable that is going to be filtered, and a third memory location called CF, into which we store the particular coefficient that we are using for implementing the exponential filter. If you look at the code, we see that the three first operations are transfer from the memory location UF of the value contained, that is the last filtered output, into the register AX, the accumulator, considered in its let's say completeness, that is both the highest part and the lowest part. Second, we subtract from the accumulator the content of the memory location IR, that is, we are calculating, as written in the previous slide, UK minus 1 minus IK. The result of this is written in the accumulator, as we know from the assembly of these microprocessors that you remember we did at the beginning of the course and belong to the Intel family. Third, The coefficient CF is moved in the register BX, and the fourth operation, the fourth instruction, is a multiplication of the content of the register AX times the content of the register BX. That is, we are multiplying CF by UK minus 1 minus IK, exactly as written in the previous slide. Consider that for such a kind of microprocessor, the multiplication of AX times BX will leave the result in the couple of registers DX, AX. In fact, we are multiplying 16 bits registers, therefore the result could be spread on to 32-bit registers, therefore we need a couple of registers to include all the result of this multiplication, and due to the particular architecture of such a microprocessor, DX together AX are the chosen one. Then we have a sum, add AX resto, and add with carry DXIR. What is happening? The second operation, I think, is quite clear, quite straightforward, because looking at the expression written in the previous slide, we have only to add IK to obtain the present filtered output, and this is done by the sum ADC DX IR that you remember contains the filter input and the present input to the block performing the filtering. Resto is a memory location that contains the result of the previous operation, of the previous filtering applied to the previous sample. And here we have two imaging that at every calculation, every time I mean, the filtered output is represented onto a set of 32 bits, but due to the fact that the coefficient we have chosen is 0.5, that is exactly the half between 0 and 1, we can say that of the 32 bits we are considering, 16 will contain the high part of the value, and the other 16 will contain the lowest part of the value. Or we could say that the highest part will correspond to the integer part of the filtered output value, while the lowest part, the lowest 16 bits, will correspond to the fractional part of this calculation. Therefore, if in the previous calculation, in the previous filtering operation, a fractional part would have been obtained, this part must be added to the new one, so as to keep the calculation correct. And this is done by adding resto to AX, because in the logic of the microprocessor, AX after the multiplication will contain the lowest 16 bits, while DX will contain the highest 16 bits. Obviously, this sum can produce a carry, therefore the second addition, the second sum, is made with carry, ADC, just to keep into consideration also this possibility. Finally, the last three instructions will save the two parts of the filtered output value, that is the highest part and the lowest part, in the memory location UF, as we said, and in the location resto, as we explained before, and finally the return instruction will come back to the main program calling this subroutine. An example will probably help to understand better how this algorithm works. And it is shown in the slide 61. In this case, we suppose to start from a situation into which the previous filtered output UF is equal to 25. IR, that is the present input, is 20. The previous filtering featured a resto, that is a fractional part, equal to 0.25. And again, as in the previous example, we suppose that the coefficient is equal to 0.5, but expressed in the integer scale with 16 bits is written as 32768. We have rewritten the code in this slide, and we have shown the content of the registers DX and AX that will contain the result. Therefore, the first instruction transfer into the accumulator the content of the memory location UF, therefore 25. Then we perform the subtraction of 20 from 25, that is the subtraction of the memory location IR, the input, from the content of the accumulator, that is the previous filtered output. AX is 5, that is, look at the content of the registers, DX is completely null, while the last three bits of AX are 101 in magenta, that is the binary codification of 5. The second instruction is simply a transfer from the memory of the coefficient CF, that is BX will be equal to 32768, and we have the multiplication of BX time AX with the result that will be contained in the X and AX. If you do the calculation by the calculator, you will understand that the representation is correct, but you can understand this also considering the fact that if you multiply a number by 32768, this is equivalent to multiply it by 2^15. And this in turn can be considered equivalent to shift that number 15 positions left. Therefore, if you consider the numbers, the digits better, represented in magenta, and you shift them 15 positions on their left, you will obtain exactly the distribution of the magenta bits as represented in the figure, a couple of them in the register DX and the remaining one in the register AX. And therefore, it comes straightforward that DX will be equal to 2 and AX will be equal to 32768. Moreover, now we perform adjustment of the fractional part, the present fractional part, with the remaining part from the last time we did such a kind of calculation. So we add AX with the memory location called the resto. This corresponds to add 2^15 plus resto, that is 0.25. But remember that 0.25 must be scaled in the new representation, in the new integer representation. Therefore, if 32768 is represented as 2^15 and corresponds to 0.5 in the modified scale, 0.25 will be the half of such a kind of representation, that is 16,384. But what it is important is that this value corresponds to 2 power 14. Therefore, AX, the fractional part of the calculation, can be written as 2 power 15 plus 2 power 14 as depicted in the figure. Finally, we will add the input IR to the X, to the integer part of the result of the multiplication. IR is 20, the X as shown in the previous result, in the previous instruction, is 2, therefore the x, the new, the x value is 22, or in other words 10110, and this is the new integer part, while the fractional part is 11 and a sequence of bits, all set to 0. If we calculate this in the decimal representation, we will say that the number represented by this couple of registers is 22.75. As already said, the last three instructions simply save the two registers in the corresponding memory locations just to be employed the next time the routine will be called, and the return simply comes back to the main program calling this subroutine. What is the error in such a kind of approximation? Okay, let's calculate this time with the calculator the value of UK as IK plus the coefficient that multiplies the difference between UK minus 1 and IK, and we will obtain 20 plus 0.5 that multiplies 25.25 minus 20. This value corresponds to 22.625. That is, we have a certain level of error, or if you want, of approximation, but it can be considerable satisfying. And in particular, allows us to perform this kind of quite complex filtering by using a microprocessor that doesn't have the floating point unit. This can be considered important because sometimes such kind of microprocessor are, let's say, simplified with respect to the most complete ones, but this brings also low power, low cost and low size, and this is an important issue if we want to use them in the embedded applications. Sometimes it happens that we deal with out of range values, for example pulse disturbances due to inductors like loads as motors, magnetic switches, or random errors can occasionally provide samples very far from the correct values. What it is possible to do in these cases? A good policy is to avoid, to eliminate the negative influence of the samples that clearly are wrong due to random or macroscopic disturbances by replacing them with more reasonable values. Often reasonable values means that they correspond to a value equal to the previous one, or a value that preserve the derivative function, and in this case we talk about first order maintaining. Other more let's say refined approaches exist that allow to discard the out-of-range values. For example, it is possible to evaluate the difference of the present value compared to the previous one or to the expected value that should be acquired. And of course, it is important also the choice of the particular value that we will use to replace the wrong one. All these approaches are, on the other hand, used before and together with filtering, averaging, and so on. And finally, a couple of words about the last level of the activity of the microprocessor or of the PC at the end of the acquisition chain. Of course, here we are not able to say many words because it depends on the particular operation that the intelligent unit will execute. We can also describe these activities from a qualitative point of view. Surely, a microprocessor or a PC is responsible for managing the regulation loops, that is, to implement and to run suitable control algorithms. Moreover, the measurements and the derived variables should be represented on a display, maybe also in a graphical form, a graphical shape to the operator so as to understand what is the behavior of what we have measured. It's a responsibility of the computational unit also printing, but in particular storing and timestamping, therefore associating the time information to the variable that has been acquired, and verifying the eventual overtaking of a threshold so as to activate suitable alarms or to take immediately the necessary operations. Of course, the intelligent unit is also responsible to implement the data communications of what we have acquired to other computers or intelligent units. And now we can say that the course has finished. You have seen this long ride considering digital interfacing, analog interfacing, some words about typical communications approaches in industrial applications, and finally we have seen a few characteristics of a typical embedded microprocessor like the ARM7. I think that the complete vision of the software, let's say soul, of the mechatronics has been given in such a kind of course. And now it's time for some exercises that will clarify the content of the exams and how to solve them. The first exercise that I want to present to you is included in the file Exercise 1 Memory Map and shows an extension of a concept that we have seen at the beginning of these lessons when we learned how to organize the architecture that allows to select suitable memory blocks starting from a map addresses distribution that is given as a specific constraint. In the figure you see that we have three blocks of memory, ROM memory 1 megabyte size, RAM 1 memory 16 megabyte size, and a second block of RAM 48 megabyte size. The ROM 1 starts as usual from the address 0, while the other addresses must be calculated on the basis of the sizes that have been assigned in the problem. First of all, let's consider 1 megabyte that corresponds to a size represented by the number 2 power 20. You surely remember that if the size of the block of memory is represented by a certain number, to evaluate the last address of that memory block, we have to subtract to that address minus 1, because typically the first address of every block of memory that we can consider starts from the address 0. This is true in particular for the ROM. Therefore, to evaluate the end address of the ROM, we have to evaluate 2 power 20 minus 1, that is represented by the sequence of ones that is shown in the figure. To solve such a kind of exercises, it is very convenient to represent the sequence of the bits from 0 to 31. Typically, we deal with 32 bits address bus microprocessors, and to set the suitable ones to a logic one or keep them to 0. In this case, from the bit 19 up to the bit 0, we need to write 1 to identify the final address of the ROM memory. Since the first block of RAM is not consecutive to the ROM block, we need to know how to start it, and this must be given as a constraint of the problem. For example, in this exam, it was fixed at 400,000 hexadecimal. That corresponds, if you transform the hexadecimal code in a binary code, to set the bit 22 in the sequence of the address bus bits to 1, while keeping the remaining ones to 0. This is clearly written in the sequence on the paper, and the final address of the block RAM 1 is 16 megabytes after. Consider that a 16 megabyte corresponds to a binary value that is power of 2, in particular to 2 power 24. Therefore, we should add 2 power 24 to the begin RAM 1 address, and just to apply the same consideration as before, we have to subtract 1 to this value. Therefore, we obtain that sequence of bits starting from the 1 corresponding to the position 24, then we have a couple of zeros, then we have a sequence of ones up to the least significant bit. The second block of RAM is consecutive to the RAM 1, therefore simply it will be starting from the address immediately after the end RAM 1, that is 1 in the bit 24, 0 in the bit 23, 1 in the bit 22, and the remaining bits set to 0. And finally, the last address that we have to consider, the end RAM 2, is obtained by adding in bits, I mean in binary codification, the equivalent of the size with which this block is considered, that is 48 megabyte. 48 megabyte can be represented as 32 plus 16, that is 16 is 2 power 24. And 32 is 2 power 25. If we add this quantity to the begin RAM 2 address, that is a 1 in the position 24 and a 1 in the position 22, and the remaining bits set to 0, we will have a 1 in the position 26 and a 1 in the position 22. But now, as in the previous cases, we have to subtract 1 to this address to consider the fact that the initial address corresponds to the position 0 in the sequence of the blocks assigned to the RAM 2. Therefore, we will have as a final address for the RAM 2 a 1 in the position 26, then 0, 0, 0, 0, and from the position 21, a set of ones up to the least significant bit. This is the distribution of the bits corresponding to the addresses that are the borders of every block of the ROM, the RAM1 and the RAM2. So we have to distinguish among them what kind of bits discriminate between the different areas, and instead what are those bits that are addressed in the same way independently if we are in ROM, in RAM1 or in RAM2. Clearly, looking at the distribution that we have written in the file, we see that we must look at the bits from 20 on, and remember we have to consider all the bits up to the end, including 28, 29, 30 and 41. Also, they are always equal to zero, because if we wouldn't do this, we would run the risk that we address a ROM or a RAM memory address, both considering those bits at one as and considering those bits as a zero. That is, our addressing architecture would be ambiguous. These bits, therefore, will be sent in input to a decoder unit, as we said at the beginning of our lessons, and this justifies that bus input to the unit called DEC from A20 up to A31. What are the lines that are necessary for addressing the ROM, the RAM1 and the RAM2? Clearly, looking at the values that these bits assume in the different blocks, we see that the bits from 20 to 31 are always zero if we are addressing the ROM memory. Therefore, the output line number 0 of the decoder unit will be connected to a logic that activates the chip select of the ROM memory. Let's make the hypothesis that the output lines of the decoder unit are high active, that is, when selected they are equal to logic 1. This is in contrast with what we claim during the course, because we several times said that the output decoding unit are low active. In this case, I make this hypothesis just to simplify the combinatorial network that follows and that activates the different chip select bits of the memory blocks. This bit is sent to an AND gate. The other input of this AND gate is the memory request control signal. Remember that when we execute an instruction like load and store that makes access to memory area, a specific memory area, the control signal memory request is activated. This signal is low active, therefore we negate it to put it as input of AND gate, and in case both of them, I mean the exit of the decoder unit and the memory request negated, are enabled, the exit of the AND is 1, negated is 0, and will enter into the chip select of the ROM that is low active, therefore enabling it. Similar considerations can be done if we consider the blocks of memory corresponding to RAM1 and RAM2, but in this case not only one address will activate those areas, therefore not only one sequence of bits of the address bus will be considered for enabling the chip select. In particular, looking at the RAM1 block, we see that the sequence of the bits starts from the group 0100, looking at the bits 23, 22, 21, 20. And the end address is defined by the bits 24, 23, 22, 21, and 20, and corresponds to a decimal value equal to 19. Therefore, the particular configuration of those bits that is equal to 4, but also the configuration that corresponds to 19, and even all the intermediate configuration, that is 5, 6, 7, up to 19, will activate the chip select of the block RAM1. This is the reason why we consider the output of the decoder unit, and we, let's say, draw a bus including all those lines from 4 to 19, and the specific one that is active in the output of the decoder is, let's say, ended together with the memory request, so as to be brought to the chip select RAM1 and to activate that block. Similar considerations are done for the activation of the RAM2 block. In this case, the group of bits that must be considered runs from 27 up to 20. The begin RAM2 address corresponds to the configuration 10100, that is in decimal 20, and the last address corresponds to the configuration 01000011, that is 67. But again, we have to imagine that all the intermediate addresses are included, and these two addresses that we have mentioned are only the borders of this group. Therefore, in the successive diagram, we select all the lines from 20 to 67 in output from the decoder, and the specific one that is activated is in end with the memory request negated. The output will be sent to the chip select RAM2, that is low active. The final part of the picture recovers the lines chip select ROM, chip select RAM1, chip select RAM2 that will be connected to the previous outputs of the AND gates that we have mentioned, and completes the configuration and the control of the memory blocks by sending to them the suitable addresses that allow to select the different cells. So, looking again at the initial bit distribution, we see that the cells of the ROM can be addressed by using the bits from 0 up to 19. The bit from 0 up to 24 are necessary to identify the cells of the RAM1 block, and the bits from A0 to A25 corresponds to the addresses that identify the cells for the block RAM2. Finally, you see also the control bits sent by the control unit of the microprocessor that are write and read for the two RAM blocks, and only read for the ROM block that, as you know, is read only. And that's all for the lesson of today. We will have the next lesson in the next week. You know that on Tuesday is vacation, so the appointment is on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock.